Pain is inevitable. Suffering is a choice. So negotiate your suffering. I think the learning for me was that out of the greatest despair has come the greatest repair. People will meditate for a lifetime to find that place. With breathwork, you can find it in 20 minutes. So we're really predisposed as a culture to seek argument and to seek a way to put our point across. It's not our natural ability. We've somehow misunderstood the distinction between normal and natural.
I'm really wondering how, especially our global leaders, would be willing to try this kind of work.
You're listening to Timeless Teachings, a global podcast with Jana Fry.
Welcome to another episode of Timeless Teachings podcast. Today, my guest is truly an enigma. I just spent a few minutes talking with him, and it is very interesting when you read something about someone, especially when you have a long list of credentials in both spiritual world and professional business world, and then person comes and you see them like in real life, and there's sparkle in the eyes, an inquisitive character, very brilliant mind, I can see it already now. And this is huge heart that truly wants to make a difference. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation, but I don't even know what we're going to talk about. So we decided to truly let it flow. So please be ready for a variety of random questions. And our guest is Anthony Avagnano. In a simple word, to me, you're one of the forefathers of the breathwork, the breathwork as we know itself. When it became really huge and like the huge industry right now, you're one of the people who started it and make it popular. And also just showed by example how can we be both spiritual and pragmatic in the best kind of way of it. So, or maybe with the other words, spiritual and grounded. So yeah. That sometimes I do find people, especially in Bali, I'm sorry to say that, tend to be a bit too aloof and too lost and living in a very small bubble, somehow not entirely related to the rest of the world. And so you are doing this beautiful work, which we're going to dive in today, elevating consciousness. And you just told me privately now your heart intention is 1 billion people through everything that you do to help them to elevate the consciousness. And I know in general, if we look at math, and I think the same, they said it also at the Maharishi University, Maharishi was also saying it, that there's this critical number of people in the society. If we, 1 billion is a lot. So if we elevate consciousness of that number of people, then the rest are going to quantum leap automatically. And then we're going to experience a new society. So Anthony, welcome to the meeting.
Thank you so much, Jana. Just in what you said, there were so many things I wanted to go, oh yeah, that makes me want to speak about this or that. So I'm excited to spend some time with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's choose one from everything that I said, or what it is that you would like to speak about. Choose one and let's dive into this.
Well, when you spoke of Maharishi, I thought, yes, we're on the same team. I love it. And there's something about this number that is magical. I mean, it's an eighth of our current world population. And some people have heard of the 100 monkeys theory, which is if 100 monkeys on one Pacific atoll learn to use knives and forks, that the other ones on the other neighboring islands will automatically know how to use them. I think that's a bit insulting to monkeys myself. And I did check out that story. I wanted to find out if it was really true. And I understand actually it's not true. But I think the theory is that if enough people are inquisitive, curious about a different way of being or a different conversation that can be had instead of the normal ones that we see in the world, then that will begin to grow exponentially. So I'm definitely a servant of that vision. How can we reach 1 billion people? And I've found that it's not just by empowering people. It's by raising one's sights and lowering one's ego a little bit and thinking in terms of, well, actually, how can I empower people to empower people? How can I actually help people get agency back in their life? That is the power of creativity and that upswell of excitement and inspiration and enthusiasm that will support them going and uplifting someone else as well. And I think there was a great statement I heard just recently. It doesn't matter how much love you give, there's always more to share. It's not like it gets divided and distributed. So what would it be like if we learn to think a different way and to approach life with that kind of generosity?
When you say that it is time for us as a society, as a humanity, to have different types of conversations, so what kind of conversations should we be having?
Well, I think that you can see if you go to Facebook and read the comments or even in LinkedIn these days, you know, you can see that dichotomy is exciting for people. And we've been taught that by casting our opinion, we cast our lot. You know, it's our vote for a thought or a belief system. And I think it's such a well-worn pathway, you could say a neuron pathway as well, to repeating the same things that we've done in the past. And when I look at the state of the world today and the chaos that it's in, I see that invitation as a dark one, not a positive one. So when I see the argument that occurs on the world stage in personal relationship, the question I'm asking is what would the third way look like? What would a new conversation look like? And what would it take for me to create it? But the problem is when we're engaged in relationships where we're so adrenaline orientated, we've learned in life that we're not alive unless we've got that coffee feeling, you know, we've just had a coffee and we're buzzing, that if that's not there, then life is a bit flat. So we're really predisposed as a culture to seek argument and to seek a way to put our point across. And then we meet someone with an opposing point of view and we have this natural escalation into what we see on the geopolitical stage today, which is, you know, really not normal. And it's not our normal natural ability. We've somehow misunderstood the distinction between normal and natural. And so we take it as normal. So I'm kind of the guy who lives on the edge of normal and is going, well, look, this is clearly not helping people. What else is there over that threshold of my comfort zone or what I think I know? What is it I don't know that I don't know? And how can I navigate that territory? What would that look like? And what is there to harvest in that space?
Well, I'm curious now to look into that space since you brought it up into the I don't know what I don't know and what is the threshold for me. For someone like you who is, at least in the eyes of other people, is highly accomplished, both spiritually and in kind of real life, what is your threshold?
Well, I think this inquiry began for me because of being an unhappy child and seeing what, as I said, what people called normal, the kind of lie that we learned to live. Now, today, it's come to the point of being an elder. And of course, when I consider, I've got a lot of history, a lot of water under my bridge, but when I've achieved what I would call mastery, what I would have wanted to achieve as a young child or a young adult, I'm now navigating what the passage looks like. You could say the rite of passage looks like from mastery to mystery. As I become less physically able, as I can't run for 2-3 kilometers anymore, I have to walk because of a beautiful knee that's managing really well but isn't up to that task, I learn to consider what does less look like, what has been abundant for me, how does that feel to explore it, because it's quite threatening in a way as we get older. I think everybody who's perhaps past their halfway point in life is suddenly thinking, oh, there's a limited amount left, I thought it never ended. And so as we negotiate that, how present can we be with it? One way of being with it is to go buy Ferraris and marry younger women as a man and find ways to avoid the actual truth of what's going on, to sit in some kind of gloat or display of accomplishment. But I think there is another way. And that gap between science and spirituality or psychology and spirituality has always fascinated me, that the scientists are kind of like trying to figure out how to create the building blocks to get there. And the spiritualists are looking down and saying, you don't need any of that. You know, this is already happening. Just open up and experience what's here. Notice what's here. So that's a place I've lived in for a long time. I love to see how we can bridge that gap. What would it take for us to bridge that gap? So that's kind of my edge right now. And of course, at my age, I've made a lot of mistakes. I don't think I would have become who I am or able to help such a wide range of people if I hadn't gone through really hating myself. I hated myself for many years. I was disgusted when I would look at myself. You know, those times that you can shave in the mirror, but you don't actually see who you are, and or you put on your makeup or whatever it might be, but you're investing in the image you project to the outer world. You're not really looking deeper. So that was a journey for me, too, to learn to look into the mirror and see underneath the surface and look into those eyes and to feel the shame of all the mistakes that I've made and the people that I've hurt, and to have to learn to love that, to have the choice to, wow, I can actually love that part of me too. And I think that, hey, that gives me street cred, you know, with the addicts, with the cruel people, with the people who are in victimhood and can't get out of. I'm a student of the human condition. And I think one of the primary things that I teach is that actually it's not personal. It's not that the universe and your family constellation and the world constellation is an orchestra that's here to destroy you. What if it's the opposite? If you were to indulge the thought of, oh my gosh, this is all about giving me what I need to uplift. So that heavy weight that one lifts in the gym isn't my enemy or making me feel weak. It's actually my opportunity to develop resilience and robustness and strength.
I could listen to you for hours and hours. And when you were sharing, especially the part as we sort of start realizing that time is not infinite. I mean, it is infinite and it is timeless, and your own timeless teachings.
Yeah.
So, which is part of that. But in our human experience, it is not. Yeah. And for some part of our life, and I think I can definitely relate to that too, it feels you can do and be anything you ever wanted, but it also feels it can go forever. That you have this infinite pool of time in front of you, but you're never going to run out. And then at some point in life, you realize actually you're crossing the Rubicon and there is a timeline.
Yeah.
And you said maybe then you start slowing down, you start being more mindful, you start saying more sorry, you connect with what really matters, you let go of what really is not no longer matter. I'm just curious for you personally, what age was that Rubicon that you felt that you're crossing something where you look at things differently?
Well, in retrospect, I would say it was much earlier than if I gave that a more superficial answer, but I think it was in my 40s. I went through a series of midlife crises. There were probably five or six of them. And then in my 50s, I got very ill as well. So I had like a seventh and eighth one of those of existential questioning. But when I look back, I think it was actually when I was very young. And it reminds me of a story in a book called Radical Forgiveness. Colin Tipping wrote the book. And this little story in the book is about this young family, and they have a daughter, and they're having a second child, and they come back from the hospital with this new little thing, this beautiful miracle child, and the daughter, the elder daughter, says, I want to spend some time with her. I want to be with her. And they said, of course you can. And she said, well, I want to be with her on my own. And so they let her into the room, to the crib, and they kept the door open just a little bit, and they heard her say to her baby sister, tell me about God because I'm beginning to forget. Breath. So whatever the God of one's understanding might be, I think at a very young age I knew. And living life meant a series of forgettings. And I think those forgettings could be referred to as blankets of forgetting, if you will, because I really used them to cover up the times that I was hurt so I wouldn't have to hurt anymore. And I don't think I realized at the time that every time I did that, I did become more protected, but I also left a part of myself under that blanket. And that part is really a part of my wholeness that fell away. And when you think of the millions of times as a child that we might have felt shocked or shamed or abused in any way at all, that means there are a lot of fragments of ourselves that are left under the blanket. And then that begs a question, well, who's here right now? Who am I declaring myself to be in front of you? Not by what I say, but by the quality of energy that emanates from me. And again, that's why it doesn't surprise me the world is in sad shape today, that there's so much chaos out there, because we're presenting really a small portion of who we are. And the rest is, you're looking at my blankets, you're looking at my colors, my images, my personas that I've learned to cultivate in order to survive, you know, to get by. So a lot of my work is also about the reclamation of those fragments of who we are, the reclamation of the fragmented self, inner child work, to use the breath, which I find the most useful and fastest tool for growth and development and definitely spiritual understanding, to help people reclaim their innocence.
You mentioned an interesting word, chaos, which sort of brought me to the idea of the book that you just released, because it does have this word on the title, right? I think if I remember correctly, it is titled Out of Chaos, Inner Calm.
That's right, yeah.
And it's, tell me about it, actually. I don't want to assume because I haven't read it yet. It just has been released. So tell me about it. Why did you write it? And what is it about?
Well, I wrote it because it's really a very good introduction to the work that I do. And it's really an invitation to look at life differently, to get off the fast pace life that we live and take a moment and have a look at what's going on. The purpose of it is to actually transform this outer chaos that surrounds us to become sovereign, to become independent of outside influence, and to learn that, and if you will, to remember that there is a core part of us that does already know, a little bit like that story I told earlier on. There's a still point in each of us, and sometimes we pass through it quite by accident, and other times people will meditate for a lifetime to find that place. With breath work, you can find it in 20 minutes or half an hour. So that's the wonderful thing about the use of breath. And from that still point, to then be able to be who you are, be more confident and more comfortable in your own skin. And then what I see happen with the hundreds of thousands of people, millions that I've worked with, see what happens. Because when we're sovereign, when we're in our own skin, and when we're empowered, then we naturally begin to inspire other people. So leadership is not a cultivated construct. Leadership is actually the disrobing from the coping systems we've used in our lives to survive and the revealing of who we really are. So that way we can lead by inspiration rather than by confrontation or control or all of the systems that we see being used in the world today.
I'm really wondering how, especially our global leaders, would be willing to try this kind of work. And I think that has been probably on the minds of many people, because I feel if they do, the world will become much more harmonious, much quicker. People have been referring to you as a visionary, whether you like it or not. So I'm curious, from that point of view, do you see that happening anytime soon? Do you see that actually these kind of tools and modalities that has been practiced, I mean, still not in the majority of the society. It's still, though it is very popular, but based on the number of people who exist on the planet, it is still a relatively minor number of people who are doing it.
Yeah.
So do you think, when are we going to tip to the other side?
Well, of course, the center of my reality is that I see everybody tipping to the other side. So I'm sort of at the nucleus of this vortex, if you will. And that's who I deal with, is people who are interested to do that. And sometimes they're interested because life's gone wrong. And other times they're interested because they're just simply inspired to do it. And I work with all of those people. That's who I want to spend my time with. There is that great statement that says you become the average of the five people you spend your time with. So I'm very conscious of that. And I think if we take one breath and just consider who those five are, wow, is there a change I want to make? Is there something that really uplifts me more? Is there someone that draws me more into my greatness than keeps me small or I allow to keep me small? So I think that's a valid question to ask ourselves. And I know that I get to measure this effectively because I have an academy that teaches people how to do breath work. I believe it's the best in the world, of course, because I wouldn't settle for less. But I see how these people who create their agency, and I put them through quite a rigorous training. It's not about get someone to breathe. It's more about do your inner work. So when you are with someone who feels suicidal or is dying or is in a deep life crisis, that you won't shy away, that you'll be able to show up and be present with them. So I see that. I can count the people that have made a journey from, let's call it, unnegotiable victimhood, that they can't transform the suffering that they have into being able to gain agency in their lives. And that 1 billion people is going to happen because people have agency. They can then become agents of change. We can then stand for something different, even though the surrounding world might be chaotic. So I'm fortunate in that sense. I've made good choices and some terrible ones too, but this one was one of the best ones I ever made. And then to see these people go and reach other people, I think, is just extraordinary. It's, you know, I see them graduate. Where I'm in Italy right now, where we have a community center and the center of our school where people come together to graduate after an online training. And my goodness, I get to see doctors, nurses, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, business people, you know, from every prisoners, people who've been in prison, every walk of life comes through. And I see them come out of this process with a belief that they can make a change, and not is as a result of their own change, and not with that ego, like, I'm your teacher. I think one thing I've noticed is that the bigger this movement gets, the smaller I become. It's not the bigger I become. I'm not a guru. I'm kind of like the person at the door saying, hey, have a look in that corner and see what's there for you. So I feel very insignificant, really, in this whole vast thing that seems to be happening. But if there's a takeaway, I think this question of leadership is one that when I'm in a circle of people or in a group or in an auditorium and I ask how many people feel like they're leaders, you get sort of a salt and peppering of people putting up their hands. And it's a trick question because I'm going to say immediately, but don't you realize you're all leading? You're all being noticed wherever you go, from the cashier in the supermarket to your children, to your husband, even to your parents, your business colleagues, wherever it is, you are casting an influence. It's just a question of how conscious you are that you're doing it. And then once you become conscious that you're doing it, you can begin to refine it and polish it and make it more true to who you are. So I think that journey to gaining agency and gaining leadership is an invitation to every single human being on this planet.
Let's take a deep breath together. And I'm curious, how did you get into the breathwork? Why breathwork?
Well, I was born. That's really how it happened. I got stuck breathing before I knew what was going on. But I think when it became meaningful to me is I was about 8 years old and at boarding school in England. And I wasn't a happy child. My dad was working real hard and my mum was working too. So I didn't have really a family unit. And I was plopped into boarding school at the age of 7. So I was lonely and unhappy. And I got teased because I'm half Italian. And in England in those days, if you weren't pure blood, I think they called blue-blooded English, you were a lesser being. And children can be unkind about that kind of thing too. So it wasn't easy to be excluded and cast out all the time. But one day, a young boy came up to me and he gave me a paper bag and he said, take 20 deep breaths into this bag. So I did. And then he squeezed his arms around my chest from behind and then gently let me down to the earth, to the floor. And I just can't quite describe what happened. I think it's as close, when I read about near-death experiences, I would say it's as close to that as it could be. It was such an immersion into benign knowing that there's a bigger picture than the one you've been looking at. It's so much bigger and it's so much more beautiful and it's so much more guaranteed to bring you joy and happiness. And now you're noticing it. Here is your dose. And so I came out of that. And I mean, I literally saw stars. I knew any question I had was the same as the answer I already knew. It was like becoming a wise old man in 35 or 40 seconds. And I was so impressed by that, that it changed my life. And I think it was my first understanding. We used to have to go to church every morning and we'd sit in there in the Church of England for 10 minutes for nobody wanted to go. We were all fidgeting and rolling up bits of paper and flicking them at each other. No, you know, God is in you. God is everywhere. What does that mean? But I think that was a moment that I understood what it meant for the first time. that spirit, I will call it, rather than God, this force of spirit does exist within us and without us. And that's a choice for us. We can make a choice for which that is. Is it going to be without us or is it going to be within us? You know, we can make that choice. And of course, that's where the word inspire comes from. It means to bring in spirit. So it's a choice we can make, or we can forget about it and just keep breathing the way we do. But something magical happens when we do give our attention to our breath. And that magic is about embracing a power that's bigger than we are.
You were 8 years old. You know, Anthony, I'm listening to you. And I'm kind of actually amazed at how many similar things happened to us, even though I was not sent to boarding school. But even with the timeline, there were like a pivotal moments in my life where exactly the same age that was happening to different moments in different areas. Do you know, I'm always sort of still surprised when you come across people and whether you call it soul fractal or whatever you call this, you know, similar energy blueprint or some kind of, you know, type of way of looking at life where you just resonate and then there's a lot of synchronicity around it. And so just listening to you, I'm noticing for myself all those moments, I'm like, wow, that is beautiful. It's like a flower that's unfolding, right? It's very beautiful to see that. And okay, so there you were, this young boy, and this I assume when the journey started, your interest in breath and work. As you said, that now you have the academy where you're teaching other people on how to do that and you're going through your own journey. If you look back on everything that happened so far, what do you feel was the most memorable experience in life, besides the one you just shared?
I think the birth of my children, which I was fortunate enough to be present for. And I also, during that time, we were taught to use breath techniques during the pregnancy. So that's actually when I first became a breath worker, one who uses the breath in a therapeutic way. And to be with my partner and to do that every day for that last 7 or 8 months of the journey, and to be present with that power during the birth, I think was enormous for me. So I'd say that was one of the most positive influences in my life. The negative ones are easy to remember. The crises and the moments of shift are easy to remember too. And that, you know, looking at oneself in the mirror and avoiding who I really am, I think was then the description to me of the journey I needed to make in order to be a whole human being. And I think there's a big lesson and that was coming up for me as I was listening to you, Jana, which is that we know about the concept of oneness and duality, and we talk about it. Sometimes people will bypass it and use mantras of oneness in order not to consider how dualistic we are as human beings. And I think the learning for me was that out of the greatest despair has come the greatest repair. So that greatest separation that I've felt from source or from my natural goodness or my innocence or my wisdom, or that odd that is inside me, has actually created the greatest opportunities to repair, to bring that separateness, that disparateness back into oneness again. And I think that for me is what our human journey is really about, is can we embrace not just the darkness of who we are as human beings, but the opposites that exist in life. You know, I was looking at a thread in one of the social media channels last night, and I was seeing some dear friends, people I've known for 25 or 30 years, argue about the situation that's in North America right now. And it just felt so sad that they had to outdo each other in their conversation in order to feel something. Not as if it's really going to change anything. It's a reinvestment in the same conversation getting bigger and more adrenaline filled and more antagonistic, actually. And you could see people just saying some things to each other. You wouldn't say that to your friend. I think that's also what gets to be embraced. How can I hold the speakers of both sides in the war at any level of conflict? What is it going to take for me and my own heart to be able to embrace the darkness in those two opposing sides as well? Because if I can do that in my own heart and recognize that I think that way too, I'm no better than either of you, but I do understand that there's work to do. You're showing me, you're giving me the raw materials that I'm going to take into my inner laboratory to do my work so I can actually be at peace with the chaos that this is creating. And if I can be at peace with this, then I'm noticing other people are attracted to, wow, gosh, how can you be in peace with this? You know, there, or some people are accusatory too. You know, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you contributing to the conversation? You know, because I want to stand for a different one. And I think that it's perhaps more available to me because of the despair of being marginalized and pushed out and being thought of as a second citizen because I wasn't British and being alone when I was at school or being abused as a child. And all of those things are actually what has led me to have appropriate compassion for other people, because we've all gone through something like that. It didn't make me worse or better. It just taught me that the ability to rebound and the ability to get back up would not be there if I hadn't been knocked down. So what does that new conversation look like? It looks like this, right? A chance to talk with you, and maybe there's one person that will twig and go, oh my God, maybe that is possible. And I think also in each of us, there's that part of us that recognizes how powerful we really are. And then come all the reasons we're not. And, you know, oh no, I could never do that. And it comes in different ways. I mean, I remember as a kid picking up a guitar and pretending I was, you know, the Allman Brothers or, you know, Elvis or someone like that. Thinking, yeah, I could do that. And I could, in my imagination, soar to a pinnacle of what I thought was at that time, you know, of success. And I think that what's happened is we've lost that imagination. We've lost that ability to be wonderfully and childfully creative. And until we bring those fragments of who we once were back into wholeness again, we're not going to notice the things that the children notice. We're not going to have the purity of vision. And we're going to get stuck under those blankets.
I am listening to you. And this is what you referred to me, that there were things that stood out for you from my sharing. There's so much that is being highlighted for me when you were talking again that I'm just, you know, it's quite amazing from just the childhood difficulty that you shared around it. And then, you know, how it made you a more compassionate person, which then brings me to the other sort of side of this conversation. Like, we are talking, you're referring to what is happening in the world. You are talking about your experience as you refer to yourself as elderly, right? I'm probably like one or two generations, you know, before you. So I can also resonate to, I would say, a lot of hardships that we had to live through if you are not the one who is fitting in the center of the society, whether it is by blood or by upbringing or anything else that's happening in your life. And what I'm curious about is actually the current generation. And you said you have children. I mean, I don't know how old they are. Actually, how old are your kids?
My oldest is 53 and my youngest is 34.
Okay.
So they're not really children anymore.
I'm a little bit older than your youngest. So let's look at generation that's maybe in their 20s right now.
Yeah.
So with this whole conversation, I'm just curious to hear how you look at it. A lot of people are saying that they had it much easier than their parents, that this is the first generation that sort of didn't have to live through any major wars, maybe not yet, you know, or kind of shortcomings in the society. And sort of there is not much, maybe besides COVID, probably, you know, there was not much kind of disturbance to the life. And there's a lot of conversation now that as a result, perhaps there's not much resilience or ability just to deal with life because did not fall down that much. So how do you back up? So let's just unpack a little bit, like, how do you see, how do you feel about it? Is it true? Is it not? And does it really have to be such a huge, looking for the word here, maybe dramatic and traumatic experience, perhaps how you and I have lived in our own way to actually to arrive where today? Maybe it is possible for the younger generation to have the same opportunity for healing and repair, in your words, with a smaller scale of drama. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, it's such a big question and it's such a big contemplation. First of all, I remember at 25, my 25th birthday, someone saying to me, what's it like to be 25? And I felt like the greatest understanding I had was that It was the first time I understood that time was accelerating. It was like 1 year from 24 to 25 is much less significant than 1 year from 7 to 8, or even less from 1 year from 1 to 2, where you've doubled your age. So I realized that time is accelerating. Now, what's this going to look like? And another thing that now I can say is that as a younger person, I felt like my perspective was the right one. There were things to learn, but I felt like my perspective was the most reliable one. And I'm really glad I did. In some ways, I was very wrong. The egotistical ways that I thought, like, I'm right and you're wrong. I wasn't right. With matters of the heart or of the spirit and things like that, I think I'm really glad that I protected that in myself. I feel very fortunate. In many ways, I think that the younger ones of us are blessed and they carry messages and reminders for the rest of us. In fact, in my classes, I've had as young as 22 years old studying with as old as 86 years old, and they have so much to exchange. It's always been a dream of mine that the kids from primary school would go to the old folks' home once a week and they can be together. And this circuitry, this instead of this linear life that we live, that we pop off when we're old enough and we leave childhood behind, that we could create a circuitry there rather than it just being such a linear experience. So I think there's something to learn at every age of life. You know, we're without war, are we? I don't know if we are without war. I mean, obviously, we know there are wars going on in the world, and some of them are very close to where we live. But I think we invest in war. It's not just the arms companies that are investing in war. I think the war begins inside, and we're not aware of that. So when I see, and I'm really quite impressed by the clarity that a lot of young people have, it's almost like a crystal clarity of where they're going, what they want, what can be done. And I'm inspired by their verve and their wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom out there. I think all the bad that's happened in our society, that the cracks have become so visible, and the young are better at noticing those cracks. They question those cracks. The rest of us would rather cover up the cracks in our authenticity with grandiosity and bluster and clever words. But I see in the children, I see that freshness that I would love to do everything I can to preserve rather than lose and have to reclaim later on. So I have a secret hope that the concept of midlife crisis might disappear in this next generation, because I see so many who are negotiating the darker stages of life with eagerness and nobility before they accumulate to be so big that the card house needs to fall. And I think that's really what the book is about, too. It's a way for life, even if you only have 10 years left or 1 year left, or if you're old enough to read, the book is designed to help us understand some really basic fundamentals. I think one of the biggest takeaways that I could say right now about the book is that we forget there's something else waiting to happen. We keep forgetting there's something else waiting to happen. And especially when we get overwhelmed by the story that, first of all, my whole being is overwhelmed, whereas usually it's just a tiny little part of us that we haven't identified that's having that feeling and it's contaminating us like a tsunami. But also that if we stay in the discomfort, if we develop the strength to stay in the discomfort and not scramble for the quickest exit, the quickest pill, the quickest coping system, there's something that's going to come into awareness that we haven't yet seen. And that's really where our resilience is born, in the willingness to be in the discomfort and to notice. And I think a perfect analogy for this is if you go into, I think they say, if you go into a pitch black room, it takes 36 seconds for the eye to be able to distinguish light and dark or form or something that might be in that room. And those 36 seconds might be 3 days or a year or a month, but I think that they're very important to negotiate, to actually become the detective of our experience. And why do I say that? Because if we don't put on our Dick Tracy hat or whoever your favorite detective is, if you're not willing to put your hat on and go in there as the detective of your human experience, things are going to happen that you're not going to notice. And a lot of them are favorable. A lot of them are teaching you where to go. A lot of them are inviting you to take your next step. So next time you feel despair, greet it with willfulness rather than letting it dominate you. And negotiate your suffering. Like I say, pain is inevitable. Suffering is a choice. So negotiate your suffering, engage with it, learn to engage with the things that chase you, like your fear and your anxiety. Develop intimacy with the things that scare you. First of all, they don't scare you anymore when you do that. And secondly, you understand, oh, there's a lot of energy in this fear. You know, sometimes it's appropriate to have it, but all those times that it's haunting me and it's not appropriate, what could I do with that energy if I could unbox it and give it a different name or give it a different use? What would that look like?
With that, after everything that we talked about today, what is one question would actually you like to ask yourself?
How can I help? Right now, in this moment, is how can I help?
Helping who?
I think everybody needs help. There's this great habit in comes from Naples in the south where they have something called a caffè sospeso. Now, everybody knows what an Italian coffee is, but not many people know what a caffè sospeso is. It means a suspended coffee. So whenever I have a coffee in the morning, which is an irregular habit, I'm not super strong on coffee, but whenever I have one, I buy a caffè sospeso. So what that means is I pay for an extra coffee. And the next person who comes in who needs a coffee and maybe can't afford it or whatever, doesn't have money in their pocket, they get given one by the bar. And I've often wondered, if the barkeepers just put it in their pocket, I wonder what actually happens with that gesture. And a couple of weeks ago, I've been living in this area of Italy now for 5 years where we have a retreat center. I went in and I paid for my coffee and I paid for my caffè sospeso. And the girl, Letizia, behind the bar said, "Oh, I wanted to tell you, there was this middle-aged lady who was really fraught who came into the bar, and I gave her a coffee, and she broke into a smile. I thought you might like to know that." So how can we help? You know, what would a random act of kindness look like for you today? And maybe tomorrow, too. What would it look like to keep sowing that seed of goodness? And no matter how badly we feel about ourselves, just make that act of generosity from our heart. I think it can change a lot.
Thank you so much, Anthony. That was such a beautiful, such a full of light and wisdom conversation. I feel very blessed with this quality time with you also. I feel I really got to know you as your person and just all the work that you do. Truly looking forward to reading the book. So we're going to look into that one. And to all our, you know, listeners and watchers, depending where you're receiving this episode in whatever format, whatever platform. If you have any questions, then I'm sure you can connect with Anthony and we will add all the links how you can get in touch. I strongly encourage also to check out the Academy. I'm myself a big fan of the breathwork. I just love breathwork genuinely. And I have been studying a variety of mystical schools and ways for more than 30 years now. It's just the way how I like to go about it. If you want to learn a particular modality, go to the source of it. So to me, when I think about breathwork, you are the source of it. And so for anyone who kind of wants to dive into that, I think it is perfect way to go. Italy is always a wonderful country to visit. What is it? Coffee sospeso, right? I heard about it days before, just in a different way. They call it like a paying forward or whatever way in English. But I think it's probably a cultural appropriation that often happens in English-speaking countries. But I love how in Italy it is just very much part of the culture. So thank you for sharing this story. And to our viewers and listeners, I see you next time with another guest.
Thank you, Yaya. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm grateful for time to spend with you too and all of you wonderful people that are watching. Many blessings.
Thank you so much for staying with us till the end. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to follow Timeless Teachings.